Hello everyone, here on the Curitania Ham System, this is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today in digest format, World Radio Magazine, the online version, for the month of October, 2010. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard Fisher. Call KI6SN. This recording is a production of the Curitania Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website is www.handyham.org. Let's go right to the World Radio Online News Front for October. FCC nixes petition to expand 15-meter phone spectrum. The Federal Communications Commission has turned down a request from a New York radio amateur to expand the spectrum available on 15 meters for phone operation. In his December 2009 petition, Richard Ebling, call K2UTC, of White Plains, New York, had proposed that the segment of the band authorized to general class and amateur X class licensees for voice emissions be increased by 75 and 50 kilohertz, respectively. He primarily argued that the frequency segment that general class licensees may use for a phone should be returned to what it was prior to the Commission's incentive licensing decision in 1967, which he believed unfairly disadvantaged general class licensees. But in its August 9 dismissal order, the FCC noted it had recently extended the spectrum amateur stations could use for voice communications in various amateur bands. In particular, the spectrum that the general class licensees may use for phone emissions in the 15-meter band was increased by 25 kilohertz. The Commission said Ebling's petition, among other things, did not present evidence that the current amount of spectrum in the 15-meter band available for voice communications is inadequate. That was filed through Amateur Radio Newsline and the FCC. The Southwest Ohio DX Association President Don Dubon, call N6JRL, has announced that 26th Annual DX Dinner will be held on Friday, May 20th, 2011, in a new location, the Dayton Marriott Hotel, 1414 South Patterson Boulevard. The event will be held in conjunction with the 2011 Dayton Hamvention. Quoting, "We are excited about our new venue," the SWODXA website said. "While it is less than 5 minutes from our previous location, it has a much larger capacity, has been recently renovated, and we will have a new menu selection. Other advantages are that there are no steps, as the dinner will be held on the ground floor, and there is ample free on-site parking. In our planning meetings, the staff has been very receptive and is anxious to meet the needs of our attendees and graciously welcome SWODXA, the web announced. From space, AO51 back in service after brief outage. AMSAT Vice President of Operations Drew Glassbrenner, call KO4MA, reported that after a brief outage aboard AO51, reported on Saturday, July 31, the amateur radio satellite was restored to service. The 145.92 slant 435.300 repeater was set to run with the 67 Hz tone required to activate the satellite, and power output was reported at 740 milliwatts. That came from Amateur News Service. Now some news from overseas. The annual Asia-Pacific DX Conventions is slated for November. The third Asia-Pacific DX Convention will be held at the Osaka International House in Osaka, Japan, between November 5 and 7 of this year. Presentations will be conducted in English and will include discussions on some recent de-expeditions along with technical discussions. There will also be an opportunity to join a tour to visit the ICOM factory and participation in a technical session led by the ICOM High Frequency Radio Design Team. CQ VHF Magazine website gets new look. CQ Communications has announced the launch of a new and easier to navigate website for CQ VHF Magazine. It's at www.cq-vhf.com/. Like the recently updated site for World Radio Online and Popular Communications, the new CQ VHF site features a cleaner look and a streamlined user interface to make it easier and quicker for visitors to find what they are looking for. CQ VHF is a quarterly magazine edited by Joe Lynch, call N6CL, devoted to ham radio above 50 MHz. First published in 1996, it combines articles designed for newcomers with historical and technical features best appreciated by more experienced VHF operators. We thank CQ Communications for that inclusion. Global Friendship, adopted for Dayton 2011 theme. When the Dayton Hamvention opens May 20th, 2011, for its 60th consecutive year, the theme, Global Friendship, will reflect an important part of ham radio, according to Michael Coulter, call WHCI, general chairman for the event. The theme emphasizes how the technology continues to bond amateur radio operators from all over the world, Coulter said. Coulter, who has more than 20 years of experience at the event, selected Joshua Long, call KD8BVB, as his assistant general chairman. Both were approved in June by the board of directors of the Dayton Amateur Radio Association, sponsor of Hamvention. Coulter noted that Long also has volunteered at Hamvention for a number of years and served as chairman of the communication committee during 2010. Quoting here, I know that Joshua will give me the kind of support needed to build upon the success of last year and to lay a foundation for another great Hamvention. NPR, first TubeSat to be MusicSat. A National Public Radio report says that one of the first of the do-it-yourself low-orbit satellite kits from Interorbital Systems has been purchased by a professional astronomer. Alex Antoun says that he will use it to create nature's own music from space, according to National Public Radio. As reported earlier this year on Amateur Radio Newsline, California-based Interorbital Systems is offering a personal satellite kit for $8,000 called TubeSat. That includes a ride into space. In the NPR interview, Antoun says that the sun interacts with the Earth's magnetic field in the ionosphere and causes all sorts of activity, according to ARN. His goal is to use his satellite to put something in orbit to convert that interaction directly to sound data so we can hear it, he said. The first TubeSats, along with an amateur radio CubeSat, are currently slated to launch on an interorbital Neptune 30 rocket from Tonga at the end of 2010. You can listen to the NPR Antoun's interview on the web. That's filed by Amateur Radio News and National Public Radio. Well, we'll go to the editor's log now. The editor, of course, is Richard Fisher, KI6SN. A freewheeling online gab brings spokespeople out in force. Have you ever operated two-wheel mobile, bicycle, or motorcycle? That turned out to be the hot topic during the World Radio Online live chat on Sunday evening, August 1. We had 112 people on board for the hour and a half gab fest beginning at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That's a zero constant UTC Monday. More than 320 comments flew fast and furious. With that many spokespeople on live, it's only fitting that two-wheel mobile amateur radio would stir up a lot of the buzz. Tim Huffnell, WA3BDV, posted from Bristol, Pennsylvania, that he was bicycle mobile many years ago and used a quarter wave whip mounted on the rear carrier. It worked better than the rubber duck, but there's no way to mount radios that won't hurt passers-by. Nowadays, Tim said he's found that the hiking and bicycle riding, my Icon P7A, with a little antenna works fine most of the time. I also carry a quarter wave whip that rolls up, which I'll add if the coverage is spotty. But I don't ride and talk. Most of my bicycle operating is either through nearby repeaters or to help coordinate the rides on Simplex, he said. I'm doing a 50K ride as part of the annual Princeton Free Wheelers event soon, and I'll have the P7A with me in the handlebar bag. I'll be listening, but paying more attention to the ride. Tim noted that for the last 30 years, the Princeton Free Wheelers sponsors a series of rides on the first Saturday of August. Rides go from 25K to 100K over hilly or flat terrain. Usually several thousand riders participate. On the bicycle, he carries only 2 meters and 440. I mostly carry the HD in case I need it. The sound of the wind in the spokes is a treat. During the August 1 chat, we put up an instant poll for the group, asking, have you ever operated bicycle mobile? Of those responding, 26% said they had. 74% had not. While VHF slant UHF appears to lead the two-wheeled popularity, the high frequencies were represented as well. Corey Sickles, WA3UVV of Glassboro, New Jersey, said he has an HF setup and have a hamstick on one bike with a Hustler RM20 and mast on the other. Another commenter, Joey Firo, W5TFW of Magnolia, Mississippi, said he could put a radio on his tractor, but he might hit a tree trying to log QSOs. Good point, Joey. That's something we'd never want to see. Do you have experiences to share with World Radio Online readers about using amateur radio aboard a two-wheeled vehicle, motorized or not? We'd like to hear about it. And photographs illustrating your two-wheel setup would help tell your story even better. Let us know by dropping an email to worldradioonline@gmail.com. We'll consider your freewheeling story for an upcoming edition of World Radio Online. Meanwhile, please remember, safety is no accident, especially on two wheels. Now listen up for more World Radio Live online chats coming up soon. Here's how the WRO Live online chats are shaping up for the rest of the year. October 3, November 7, and December 5. Of course, we have every intention of carrying on with them into the new year. The schedule will be announced as soon as we can get our hands on a 2011 calendar. Your interest in WRO chat portal, as always, is through the World Radio Online blog. Hope to see you there. The Editor's Log by Richard Fisher, Kilo India 6, Sierra November. What follows now is a very nice featured article. It's titled R&R, Radio and Relaxation Equals the Great Family Vacation. The author, Gene Bartz, B-A-R-T-S-C-H, his call is WY7N. There are a lot of photographs here. The Aries Island vertical strikes a beautiful pose with the sun and water as a backdrop. When I was first licensed years ago as a teenager, I dreamed of operating someday from a rare exotic location. Rather than spending hours calling a DX station, I'd be the guy on the other end of the pileup. Handing out the contacts in rapid succession certainly seemed more fun than endlessly trying for even a single QSO with a rare entity. Reality has a nasty habit of intruding on dreams. College and marriage and kids and buying a house and paying the bills took priority over ham radio ambitions. Still, I eagerly read the magazine articles describing trips made by others to remote places. Sometimes those journeys require days of tiring air travel or weeks churning through storm-tossed seas to reach a place where one might be subjected to coral cuts and biting insects and blistering heat, or perhaps snow and ice and howling winds able to flatten antennas and rip sturdy tents to shreds. Those obstacles didn't bother me when I was young, but as years passed, they seemed far more intimidating. I reached a tipping point following a series of Boy Scout campouts with my son, where I found that I no longer enjoyed sleeping in a tent on frozen ground. That a weekend of continuous rain in a soggy campground is miserable, and that summer heat and biting insects aren't very enjoyable either. And far more unpleasant and even dangerous conditions can be experienced by ham operators at a rare location. I admire those who go on those difficult expeditions to exotic locations, but I no longer wanted to join them. Okay, there are other places, perhaps less rare but more comfortable, where one can experience the thrill of being the sought-after station in a pileup, and I considered the possibilities. Operation from a semi-rare location during a contest seemed a good choice, and combining the trip with a family vacation trip would save money. My wife was lukewarm on the idea, but agreed to let me give it a try. An Island on the Air, that's IOTA, contest was my first attempt at combining a vacation with ham radio. We live near Portland, Oregon, and the San Juan Islands of Washington State are within relatively easy driving distance. We chose Orcas Island and rented a house situated on 5 acres near the shore, arriving there several days before the IOTA contest for a week-long stay. Since we were driving instead of flying, I had plenty of room for my Kenwood TS-940 transceiver, my Ameritron AL-80B amplifier, a borrowed Hustler 4BTV 40-10 meter vertical, and could easily carry my coax and test equipment and tools. The trip from Portland to the ferry in Anne's Cortes, Washington, took 4 hours. The ferry ride to Orcas Island lasted another hour, but that consisted mostly of watching beautiful scenery with bald eagles and dolphins while eating the delicious clam chowder served aboard. Another half hour of driving after reaching the island, and we were at the house. I was on the air an hour later. I situated my 40-10 meter antenna on the hillside above the house, only a short distance from the water. Other islands visible in the distance completed the peaceful scene. Since this was primarily a family vacation, I wanted my wife and 2 children to enjoy themselves and made sure I didn't skip on sightseeing or hiking or going to the beach or eating out. Although I only operated briefly each evening, making 50 or 100 QSOs each day was fun, the island hunters seemed to appreciate the contacts. The following days were relaxing. Deer grazed in the yard and bald eagles fished in the waters offshore. The tides came and went. Huge ferry boats passed the island frequently. At night they looked like floating, brightly lit Christmas trees. During the IOTA contest, it was great to be on the receiving end of a modest pileup, and I had fun making several hundred contacts. Every person in the family declared the vacation an enjoyable one. The next year, my wife was agreeable to visiting Nantucket Island for a week-long vacation that included the IOTA contest. When contacting realtors on Nantucket, I requested a house with a yard and tall trees because I planned to bring simple wire antennas and use them with my ICOM IC706 transceiver. After receiving assurances that the house we selected had numerous tall trees, I sent my deposit. Here's a hint. Ask how tall the trees are in actual feet before signing the contract. If you come from a place like Oregon, where only trees 100 or more feet high are considered tall, you might otherwise be disappointed with the 15-foot high trees you find when you arrive at your destination. I could easily reach the center connector of my dipole by standing on a lawn chair. Still, live and learn. Using only that low-height dipole, I was able to work a few hundred stations during the contest. My experience at combining family vacations with a few hours of operating time resulted in many additional ham radio vacations over the years. I now have an airline carry-on pack that contains everything needed for a casual vacation operation, my ICOM IC706 transceiver, an Astron SS25M power supply, a microphone, a telegraph key, a few lengths of RG58 coax, and several rolled-up dipoles. I've used this equipment successfully while on vacation in Wyoming, semi-rare in some contest, from Canada, and during a visit to France, where it was fun to have 5-alpha-1-alpha answer my CQ instead of fighting for a pileup for a contact with him. And making contacts with European stations on 6 meters isn't something I can usually accomplish from the Pacific Northwest. Our most recent family vacation was to Hawaii, which is not particularly rare, but I always find it interesting to operate from somewhere new. Within an hour of our arrival, I had set up my simple station, erected a dipole, and called CQ. Before going to bed an hour later, I had worked 35 stations in Europe. I encourage others to try a relaxed ham radio operation while on vacation. You don't need to spend tens of thousands of dollars to experience the thrill of a small pileup. Operating from a state with a low ham population like Wyoming or North Dakota or Vermont can make you popular during a contest. Checking my logs, I found that a few other places like South Carolina, Mississippi, and sometimes West Virginia may be the only sections I've missed during a contest. And those are easily reached from nearby states with large ham populations. Operating from a rare county during the state QSO party or from a rare grid during a VHF contest can also generate plenty of calls. Just like operating from an island during the IOTA contest, you don't need to travel overseas to experience a modest pileup. Not interested in contests? Choose any somewhat rare place for a family vacation and operate casually for a few minutes each evening. See what the ham band sounds like from a new place. Providing a contact that someone needs is rewarding. Try it, and I think you'll have fun. Let's go now to DX World, a title, a DX cluster primer, seeing what others are hearing. The author Kelly Jones and 0VD. First a quotation, because the DX cluster is a worldwide network, you have the benefit of seeing what others are hearing. So, instead of just tuning around the bands yourself, you have the ears of many others who are also tuning the bands. When somebody hears a DX station, they can post this information on the cluster, on the internet, of course, for all to see. Now you know exactly where to go to find that DX station you're chasing. As fall arrives and the days become shorter, chances are you will be spending more time in front of the radio. As an avid DXer, one of the things I enjoy about chasing DX is the use of the DX clusters. While this tool has been around for nearly 20 years and is often very polarizing in some circles, I still run across DXers who have never used a cluster. The grandfathers of the packet cluster, as it was called years ago, are Dick Newell, call AK1A, and Ken Wolf, K1EA. While the technology has changed over the years, the original concept has not. DX clusters are an effective way for you to pick up that elusive new one and add to your country totals. In the early days of the cluster network, nodes were typically linked by RF radio frequency using packet radio, hence the name packet cluster. It was also very common at the time for nodes to be located many miles apart. The problem with RF linking at the time was that the network was more or less a peer-to-peer network. That means if somebody's link in the middle went down, we'd end up with orphaned nodes. While the network would run fine for days on end, it never failed that when a major contest came along, the cluster network would inevitably break into many pieces and essentially render it, by today's standard, useless. Remember, packet speed in those days was primarily 1,200 baud. Somewhere around 1996, I began experimenting with using the internet to link clusters. What a fantastic leap forward this was. No longer did you have to worry about the RF links breaking. However, in 1996, the internet was still relatively young and the Windows operating system was still new to most people. Sure, Windows 3.1 was around, but remember that Win 3.1 ran on top of DOS. And if you were playing with computers back then, I'm sure you can recall how much of a challenge it was to run network under DOS. While DOS networking had its own set of issues, the node-to-node linking using the internet was far superior to RF linking. The Alpha Kilo 1 Alpha software was pretty much the de facto standard until the late 1990s. At that time, other clones began to pop up. One of the early clones that was quickly adopted was called CLX, an acronym for Cluster, which is the CL, software running under Linux, the X in Linux. CLX proved to be popular for many years. However, by the early to mid-2000s, the original AK1A packet cluster and CLX had pretty much run their life cycle. During this time, we saw the rise of the next generation of cluster software, with the likes of AR Cluster, DX Spider, and CC Cluster, all which have more or less become the three primary DX cluster software packages on the market today, with DX Spider being the most popular. So, how can the DX cluster network help you in your endeavors? The old saying goes, a picture is worth a thousand words. One could argue, a cluster is worth a thousand ears. Because the DX cluster is a worldwide network, you have the benefit of seeing what others are hearing. So instead of just tuning around the band yourself, you have the ears of many others that are also tuning the bands. When somebody hears a DX station, they can post this information to the cluster for all to see. Now you know exactly where to go to find that DX station. So how do you tap into the information that is flowing through the DX cluster network? The truth is, doing so has become quite trivial these days. Many logging and contest programs have a cluster window built in. They allow you to simply choose a node, give it a few pieces of information, such as your call sign, and you're ready to go. If you haven't taken the leap into computer logging, there are a few web clusters which allow you to join the cluster network by way of your browser. Two examples of web clusters are DX Summit, www.dxsummit.fi/the < and DX Central, www.dxcentral.com/ followed by the less than key. DX Summit was the first web cluster and has been around since about 1997. DX Central followed shortly thereafter, launching in 1999. Now for the listener, the article goes on several pages and can start to sound a little technical for those of you not too adept at not only clusters, but also internet connections, even if you have an internet connection. I suggest you sit with the person who can read with and for you, if necessary, to get into something very popular. That's the DX cluster information. One specific bit of information included here, a great resource for finding more information and even a cluster to connect to on the internet, is dxcluster.info. It's www.dxcluster.info/ and the less than key. It's a site maintained by Jim Rissert, AD1C, and is a wealth of knowledge to get you started. This article titled "A DX Cluster Primer, Seeing What Others Are Hearing" was by Kelly Jones, November 0, Victor Delta. Let's go to Hams with Class, Dayton Youth Forum, Part 2, The People Who Make It Happen. The author, Carol Perry, WB2MGP. What a wonderful gift of time. This year, the terrific folks at the Dayton Amateur Radio Association, DARA, DARA, generously gave me a 3-hour session for our Saturday morning time slot of the 23rd Annual Youth Forum at the Dayton Hamvention recently conducted. It was very exciting to be part of this special event on May 15 with the 9 young speakers who gave such excellent presentations. In part 1 of Hams with Class, Dayton Report in the World Radio Online's August edition, I highlighted the youngsters who spoke and summarized what their interesting and impressive talks were about. I was a very proud moderator that day. There are so many wonderful people who work diligently to make this annual forum a success. Several co-sponsors of the Youth Forum, as well as some people with exciting announcements for the kids, stopped by to wish them well. Ken Salhoff, N4TCP, had volunteered to help us out after he had attended the 2009 Youth Forum. He made a wonderful surprise announcement at the start of the forum that he would be producing anodized aluminum dog tags personalized with the children's call signs and names in a choice of colors. Every youngster in the audience, as well as every young speaker, had their own personalized souvenir mailed to them by Ken. He even surprised the moderator with one. I love mine, and I wear it all the time. Thank you, Ken. Fellow Radio Club of America director Tim Duffy, K3LR, and his Young Contest University student Cal Durula, K0DXC, spoke at my instructor's forum and at the youth forum about this wonderful event that now takes place in Dayton. Contest University was started in 2007 by Tim. He noticed the Potomac Valley Radio Club had conducted a contesting-related seminar in Washington, D.C.'s area that was highly attended. Combining the idea of contesting presentations for an entire day alongside the Dayton Hamvention seemed like a great idea. Tim assembled world-class presenters, professors if you will, and announced the first event in January 2007. ICOM America has been a substantial supporter from the beginning. Nearly 150 attended the first CTU in Dayton in May 2007. CTU, Contest University, was off and running. Since that time, nearly 1,200 amateur radio contest enthusiasts have attended the 9 CTUs in 4 countries. Every CTU has had a scholarship program for operators under 25 years of age that is 100% funded by donations. In 2011, CTU Dayton will increase its focus on youth contest operating, with Scott Jones, called W3TX, and me leading the initiative. CTU will add a classroom totally dedicated to youth radio operating and learning. Ray Novak, called N9JA, ICOM America's General Manager of Amateur Products, is a longtime friend of our youth forum. Through Ray, ICOM donated a dual band HD to every one of my 9 young speakers. Gordon West, called WB6NOA, another fellow RCA member, greeted the audience in his usual flamboyant manner, dressed as a professor. He called up several kids to demonstrate exciting ways of teaching basic principles. It's always fun to have Gordon at our forums. I personally use his excellent study guides and training manuals when introducing a new radio program in school. Martin Jew, K9FLU, CEO and founder of MJF Enterprises, has been a supporter of my educational endeavors for almost 30 years. He has always been there for us when we needed door prizes for the instructors' forum, as well as for the youth forum in Dayton. His wonderful, heartfelt talk to our audience about the importance of young people choosing their hobbies carefully and being passionate about it was extremely well received. He told of his own experience as a young boy, first getting involved with building a crystal radio at 8 years old, enjoying reading about it, being a Cub Scout, and how it led to a lifelong passion and the founding of a most successful business, MFJ Enterprises. Bob Heal, K9EID of Heal Sound, wasn't able to make it to the youth forum, but spoke at the instructor's forum about the importance of getting kids interested in radio technology. He was a sponsor of that forum as well. We are proud to have Kenwood join us as a co-sponsor of both my forums this year. It was my pleasure to introduce Roy Wildermuth, called W2IT, who was the AWA, that's Antique Wireless Association Banquet Chairman this year. Roy has invited me to be keynote speaker at their conference in Rochester, New York, in August 17th through 21. He announced the launching of their Give a Kid a Rig campaign, which will raise money through the sale of used radios and through donations, which will go directly to the RCA Educational Youth Activities Fund. Enough things can't be said about all the above-mentioned co-sponsors who do so much work to help make sure that the Youth Forum is a fun, educational, and inspiring experience for all the young people. Special thanks go to the DARA, the Dayton Amateur Radio Association, for its tremendous support and promotion of youth in amateur radio. Please have technically talented and enthusiastic youngsters you meet contact me this fall if they'd like to speak at the Youth Forum next May. Now again, for the listener, that's the category of Hams in Class, the author Carol Perry, WB2MGP. Now, folks, I looked back over the article to see if Carol had listed her email address. It doesn't seem to be in the article, which is a little unusual. Maybe I missed it somewhere. But you can always look her up on an amateur radio-based call sign website. Well, as I checked the time, we're at the 36-minute-plus mark on this month's recording of World Radio Online in digest format here on the Courage Handy Ham system. Let's go to Hamfests and special events. The month of October, Indiana, special event station W9JOZ from the town that never was. October 2nd, sponsored by the Stark County Amateur Radio Club, operates from Radioville, Indiana, a town that was to be developed as a city, but it all fell through. It is still recognized by the state as a town, even though nothing was ever developed there. W9JOC will operate from Radioville on 10 through 80 meters from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Central Standard Time. That's October 2nd. You can QSL via the call book address. The great city of New York Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club Hamfest is being held at the New York Hall of Science parking lot, Flushing Meadow, Corona Park, Queens, on October 3. Doors open for vendors at 7:30 a.m. Buyers are admitted at 9 a.m. Jump all the way across to California, special event station N6W, November 6 Whiskey, in commemoration of National Wildlife Refuge Week, Sunday, October 10, and Saturday, October 16, operating at the Kern County Wildlife Refuge in Delano, California. Operating both days on 20 meters around the frequency 14.240 plus or minus the noise level. State of Wisconsin, USS Cobia, Amateur Radio Club, call NB9QV. World War II submarine, USS Cobia. Their number is AGSS245. We'll be on the air commemorating the 28 submarines that were built in Manitowoc, Wisconsin during the World War II era. That's dated as October 23 and 24. Lots of frequencies, so just want to look around and listen well. State of Virginia, Lynchburg Amateur Radio Club, call N4J, November 4, Juliet. Archaeology open house at Thomas Jefferson's Poplar Forest, his retreat home and farm in Bedford County, Virginia. Uncovering evidence of life and work on the plantation 200 years ago. If you like to think about and do things about archaeology, you want to check them out on October 9, Forest, Virginia, at various frequencies as well. State of Alaska, the 2010 National Wildlife Refuge Week, October 15 through 17, Alaska Hams, Friends of Alaska National Wildlife Refuge, the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, Homer, Alaska, various frequencies. Massachusetts, K1W, Kilo One Whiskey, from National Wildlife Refuge Week, Parker River, NWR, Newburyport, Massachusetts. Penticook Radio Association, October 9 through 17. In New Jersey, special event station N2CMC. November 2, Charlie Mike Charlie, Cape May County Amateur Radio Club from Wildwood, New Jersey. That'll be on October 2nd, the 35th anniversary. It'll be at the former United States Coast Guard Lorraine unit at Wildwood, New Jersey. Oh, we have another Massachusetts one that slipped in here. Call N1P, November 1, Papa. Special event station from Franklin County Pumpkin Fest 2010. Saturday, October 23rd in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. Number 1 Pumpkin. State of Texas, Ham Expo, October 2nd, Bell County Expo Center. Another great take for you that like to go to special events or listen to them on the radio. Always an interesting take. And of course, folks, the magazines always carry the whole lists of contests that are on the air continuously, most of them on weekends, but throughout the entire world. And if you are at all interested in listening to what goes on in amateur radio or long-distance radio listening, just a really good receiver would be effective enough to catch a lot of this action on the radios. And for those that would take it a step or two further, there are continuously being held VF examinations, volunteer examiner examinations, as a service to people interested in learning more about amateur radio, and of course passing the tests that are required to be licensed by the Federal Communications Commission. You go to these different places that are usually held at amateur radio clubs throughout the country. You can find out where they are if you really are interested in that as well. I suppose that last comment sort of gets me right into promotion and recruitment. That wasn't the way I planned this. I sort of wing it here in the early morning hours. But having noticed that, I go back to the reading of the material. Strategies for Updating Our Promotional Toolkit. The author, DeVere D. Logan, called W1HEO. Change is one of the constant challenges we face as members of the human race. And changes are certainly affecting the way we promote and publicize amateur radio. Consider how the media is moving away from print and toward digital and the internet options. Certainly, World Radio Online is a prime example of this. So as we plan our promotional activities, let's be flexible and consider using newer approaches when appropriate. We were reminded of this while reviewing the contents of the 50-page promotional how-to manual, or toolkit, that the Ham Radio Promotion Project provides to participating radio clubs. Sending hard copy news releases via regular mail or fax to the print or broadcast media used to be the gold standard. No more. The explosive growth of electronic communications such as email, cell phones, Facebook, texting, and similar modes requires that we include them in our plans. So our toolkit is regularly updated to include them. Traditional media can't be ignored, however. People still turn there for news. A survey by the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press found that television is the number one choice for local news. They claim at 64%, followed by newspapers and the internet. There are several important differences to consider with the so-called social media, such as Facebook and Twitter, or texting. These demand that your message be concise and to the point while avoiding excess verbiage. Social media allow you to focus on specific targeted audiences and even solicit feedback if necessary. Facebook enables you to add pictures and links and isn't limited to the 140 character limitations of Twitter. Gee, I didn't know that. I'm getting old, I guess, huh, folks? Immediate feedback and interactive dialogues with audiences certainly are a contrast to the old one-way printed news release. Instead of depending upon editors to tell your story, there's potential for a more conversational exchange of information and handling questions in real time. The downside is that true interactive media require that someone be available to engage in a dialogue. Writing a news release for distribution via email or social media channels requires a different approach than the old inverted pyramid style of writing taught for years in journalism schools. For example, Instead of including the who, what, where, when, and why in the first paragraph, I remember that, a short, catchy sentence and a few words in the text is more appropriate. Not all the main facts need to be squeezed into the lead. While there are benefits for having a variety of new communication channels available, let's remember the importance of the content of our messages. The medium itself isn't the message, so stay focused on what you have to say. That's what counts. A major reason for ham radio promotion is to recruit new licensees. So how are we doing? In the first 6 months of 2010, there were 18,270 new amateur radio licenses issued, which is about 8.5% higher than last year. In the same period of 2009, the FCC issued 16,844 new licenses. That's an encouraging trend indeed. We hasten to add, however, that we shouldn't become complacent. Trend is not destiny. One of the oldest but most useful ways to present our message to the public is the display. Interesting and attractive designs can do a good job of publicizing amateur radio and recruiting new club members. Does your club have a display that introduces both ham radio and your group? It can be made quite inexpensively, so it won't break the bank. A custom display was developed by the Indian Hills Radio Club of Wickliffe, Ohio, as part of a program to introduce ham radio to the public, using an existing library display case. The shelves held various radio books and magazines, small transceivers and handy talkies, a world prefix map, and placards with information on ham radio and details of the upcoming program. Another valuable use for a radio club display is at a local ham fest. Put it on your table and offer copies of your club newsletter and a promotional handout listing some of the group's attractions as well as programs, nets, licensing courses, and social events. Be sure to invite the visitors to your table to leave their name, call, address, and email. You may want to use them to deliver a mailing list of prospective members. This writing under promotion and recruitment is offered by Devere, D-D-E-E, Logan, call Whiskey One, Hotel Echo, Oscar. D is a 40-year ham radio veteran who is an accredited member of the Public Relations Society of America and a member of its College of Fellows. Let's take a look now at amateur satellites. Money certainly helps make the satellites go round. By Terry Dodds and 8KI. At the Dayton Hamvention, a challenge was issued by the Dayton Amateur Radio Association for a 1-for-1 matching gift to AmpSat North America of up to $5,000. The goal was met in less than 2 months due to the generosity of AmpSat members and others. These donations will help to support getting AmpSat back into space. The DARA, that's the Dayton Amateur Radio Association, the President Steve Coys, call K8UD, wrote to AmpSat President Barry Baines, WD4ASW, saying, "I am glad that this promotion has worked well, and am looking forward to other endeavors in the future." AmpSat has been a major attraction to Hamvention for many years, and hopefully for many years to come. I hope other organizations will step up with similar programs. Launches have not been going down in price. However, with the recent launch of Falcon 9, perhaps there may be other opportunities in the future. We all need to continuously look outside the box for new solutions. Again, DARA congratulates all the AmpSat members and best wishes for the new satellite. While this one-for-one matching opportunity has been met, AmpSat continues on its capital drive to raise $100,000 in both 2010 and 2011. One AmpSat member has just agreed to pledge $500 to AmpSat as an additional one-for-one matching opportunity. So donations made now will continue to grow. In the Future Fun Events Department in 2010, AmpSat Space Symposium, an annual meeting, will be held on October 8 through 10 at the Chicago Elk Grove Holiday Inn located near O'Hare International Airport. The 2010 Symposium Committee has completed the room reservation and registration details for the event. The hotel booking code for the Elk Grove Village Holiday Inn is AMS for the AMSAT convention. On Sunday, following the conclusion of the symposium activities, you are invited to participate in a tour of the Tevatron at the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. Part of the activity will be a tour of the multi-megawatt RF portion of the particle accelerator, as well as a tour of the new superconducting RF test facility. The planned tour start time for the Fermi Lab is about noontime. In a story that was first reported in the European EE Times, Vermont Technical College, Norwich University, St. Michael's College, and the University of Vermont are working together to land a CubeSat on the moon. A team is currently working on initial designs for the spacecraft with the aim of achieving further NASA funding in June 2011. Primary funding for this effort is being provided by the Vermont Space Grant Consortium under a NASA grant. In the current phase of the program, the Vermont CubeSat project, led by Professor Carl Brandon of Vermont Technical College, aims to launch by 2015. It is developing the first CubeSat that can be launched from a geostationary orbit to successfully land on the moon. The CubeSat electronics are based on the Texas Instruments MSP430 processor, and the software will control navigation, communications, scientific instruments, camera, and the CubeSat's propulsion system. The proposed lunar lander will be a single-unit CubeSat with four mini-thrusters on the bottom to maximize control and maneuverability. Two potential options for propulsion are being examined: a bipropellant booster or a Xeon-powered Ion Drive booster. The Xeon thruster can also be used for a triple CubeSat that would go to and orbit the moon. This will be an exciting project, and if it is successful, it will bring a new level of sophistication to the development and use of CubeSats. There's a lot more information about the satellite program in every issue of World Radio. Well, we just talked about outer space and CubeSat little satellites. Might as well stay in that area with Mars. Wait a minute, M-A-R-S, That's a really military affiliate radio system, not the planet up there. After connecting all the dots, MCOM faces a tougher task, connecting all the agencies. The author here is Bill Sexton. His amateur call is N1IN. What a station for contesting the 20-by-20-foot shack booths, four fully equipped operating positions with networked computers, broadband internet, and emergency power. There's air conditioning, too, and refrigerator and coffee pot, of course. To cut feed line loss, the station sits directly underneath the high-rise antenna farm. But when Gary Sessoms, KC5QCN, and his team fire up the rigs for an evening's high-stakes drill, it's not about scoring points and multipliers. It's about defending the homeland. Meet Whiskey Alpha Romeo, the Mars station staffed by members of the Pentagon Amateur Radio Club on the top floor of the Department of Defense's vast headquarters outside Washington, D.C. A Marsnet, you might have heard their other call signs, AAN3PNT, that's the Army, AGA3DC, that's the Air Force, and NNN0PNT, the Navy Marine Corps. The 60-odd members all have two things in common. Whether military or civilian, government employee or contractor, active duty or retiree, each is or has been stationed at the Pentagon. And given the security clearances that go with the jobs, their mission statement justifiably struts a bit. WAR, War, it says, provides backup communications for the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the National Military Command Center. Very impressive. Most recently, four WAR volunteers teamed up the Joint Defense Department exercises testing real-life contingency communication between commanders on the ground and military assets that are airborne. details, such as the nature of the military assets, are classified except to say participants used automatic link establishment for handling traffic with planes aloft, and the drills have taken place over a period of months. Now here's a hymns I view of ALE, A-L-E. It's a fairly exclusive group, although anyone may join. They're the hams trained, equipped, and ready to roll in an emergency with automatic link establishments on the amateur radio bands. Around 15 or 20 stations worldwide regularly congregate on 8 preset data channels, provided the frequencies aren't in use for other modes. Each ham radio AIL station uses the operator's call sign as an address in the AIL controller. When not actively in the QSO with another station, each HF single sideband transceiver constantly scans through a list of frequencies called channels in ALE jargon, listening for its call sign. To reach a specific station, the caller simply enters the call sign just like dialing a phone number. The ALE controller selects the best available frequency and sends out brief selective calling signals containing the call signs. When the distance scanning station detects the first few characters of its call sign, it stops scanning and stays on that frequency. The two stations' ALE controllers automatically handshake to confirm that a link is established and they are ready to communicate. The receiving station, which was muted up until then, will typically emit an audible alarm and visual alert for the receiving station of the incoming call. Indicates the call sign of the linked station. The operators can then continue with their QSO or conversation. So there's another aspect to amateur radio operating through the military affiliate radio system. That one happens to be a very specifically and controlled operation, but all the same, it's important to our national security. Well, this is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot N1 BLF. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We're about 50 miles south of Boston, right near Buzzards Bay, as you head down toward good old Cape Cod. I've been reading for you in digest format World Radio Magazine, the online version, for October 2010. World Radio is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor, Richard Fisher, KI6SN, and the editorial director, Richard S. Mawson, called W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Anti-Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. It's always spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M @courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. Thanks again for listening along. Bob Zeta, N1BLF, 73.